Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. This hour, we learn all about Edward Snowden, who he is, why he did what he did, and what the repercussions of the publication of so many, many documents meant for The Guardian and for the journalists who decided that they would publish these documents. The author of a really, really interesting book is with us this hour, Luke Harding. The book is The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. And Luke is a journalist, a writer, an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian. He's reported from Delhi, Berlin, Moscow, covered the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria. And between 2007 and 2011, he was the Guardian's Moscow bureau chief. The Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. The review of this book in the International New York Times reads, "The saga of Edward Snowden, the man whose leaked documents revealed the Orwellian dimensions of the National Security Agency, reads like a Le Carré novel crossed with something by Kafka. At least it does in Luke Harding's new book, The Snowden Files." Luke is author of three previous nonfiction works, including WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy. He lives in Hertfordshire, England, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Luke during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Leave messages there. And we are also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Hi, Luke. Thanks very much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's great to be with you, and thank you for the very generous introduction at the start of your program.
Oh, you're entirely welcome. The book is terrific. It's such a fascinating story, but I must say you're one heck of a writer. It's a real page-turner, isn't it?
I mean, it felt like a thriller from the very beginning. That felt like the most appropriate genre to do. I mean, not least because the action shifts kaleidoscopically. One minute you're in Hawaii, then you're in Hong Kong, then you're in Moscow, and there's a furor in New York, Washington, London, Berlin,
right.
Brazil,
yeah.
And so on. So I wanted to kind of reach out to the general reader, Kathleen, to people who had maybe followed the Snowden affair but didn't have a kind of definite view one way or the other, and to try and kind of pull it all together in a compelling way.
Let's start with what commonly is not known about Snowden. You went through a lot of his emails. He was using this name, The True Hoo-Ha, at an arts technical website in which you found out a lot about what his political views used to be.
Well, that's right. Snowden's a relatively reserved person. He hasn't said a tremendous amount about himself. But ironically, there is this kind of very full electronic record, I use a German word, like a kind of Bildungsroman, a sort of novel of youthful experience. But he started blogging on this website, Ars Technica, anonymously at the age of 18. And he kept it up for almost a decade. And what emerges, I think, is someone who is very smart, has a lot of kind of intelligence, can be quite sardonic, quite sarcastic towards other people whom he thinks are kind of less smart than he is, but who comes from a patriotic, Republican, even kind of libertarian standpoint. He's on the right of the political spectrum. And really, we can kind of trace him as someone who initially, at least, very much believes in the system.
Mm-hmm. Very supportive of Ron Paul.
Yeah, he even donated to Ron Paul subsequently in 2012. He donated $250 to his campaign. And he was an enthusiast for Ron Paul. He didn't mind Senator John McCain. He didn't much like Obama, but wasn't kind of heartbroken when Obama became president.
Mm-hmm.
And really was expecting Obama to reverse these extraordinary data collection programs, which he came across as a kind of contractor from the National Security Agency, hoovering up everybody's email data, telephone records, and so on.
Hmm. His tech skills, Luke, must have been rather extraordinary to get jobs with the CIA and to have all of this information and know how to distribute it, know how to gather it. That's not an easy thing. You have to really know technically what's going on, don't you?
Technically, he was very brilliant. He never actually finished high school. He didn't go to college, to university. So from an academic point of view, he was a failure and a dropout. But what he was very good at from a very early age was he was extremely competent at computers. And I think this actually goes to the heart of the dilemma for the spy agencies and the White House more generally, that really what they need is people who have super technical skills. And where do they find them? They find them from the young generation of guys like Snowden, under the age of 30, who are digital natives and grew up with computers. But these same people feel passionately attached to the internet and feel, in Snowden's case, that they should defend it when it comes under attack.
He was had a failed interlude, you write, in the Army. He broke both his legs. Is that right?
Well, strange though it seems, it does sound like something out of a kind of boy's own adventure story, but he really did try and join an elite sort of regiment, and he did basic training. And I have to say he's a rather unlikely soldier. I mean, he kept himself extremely fit, but he's short. He's quite badly short-sighted. His feet were too small. He wrote about he couldn't actually find a pair of army boots that fitted him. And then, yeah, he broke his legs and he was discharged. He lasted about 6 weeks.
Why did he join the Army?
Because he had this, he had a kind of noble vision, if you like. Bear in mind that he comes from a very patriotic family. His father served in the U.S. Coast Guard for 3 decades. And when the war in Iraq happened, he wanted to help the oppressed people of the Middle East, if you like. I mean, he was really was a believer in the kind of Bush project, but pretty quickly he found that during basic training that most of his superiors, they just wanted to kind of kill people, and there was no noble mission at all. So it was a complete mismatch.
Mm-hmm. The CIA, he worked for the CIA. He grew disillusioned with them when he was in Switzerland. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, pretty quickly, he's scaling up the intelligence ladder. So he's parlaying his computer skills into better and better jobs. And at the age of 24, he gets a big break. He's sent to Switzerland, sent to Europe, to basically be the IT guy at the U.S. mission in Geneva. And this is quite an interesting moment in the Snowden story, because on the one hand, it's a big adventure. He's a young guy actually traveling around southern Europe, riding motorbikes, meeting Europeans and so on. But gradually, what we find during this period, he's there for about 3 years, is that he becomes increasingly disillusioned with the system that he's servicing. And this, I think, is where the idea of becoming a whistleblower, of leaking secret information, first came to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it grows and grows and grows until by the time he arrives in Hawaii in sort of 2013, he really is a bomb about to go off.
Yeah. The Hawaii chapters are so fascinating, partially because his girlfriend is so fascinating, too, and the pictures she's taking of him and his growing disillusionment. It's quite a time in his life, isn't it? She was a pole dancer?
Again, this is quite curious. I mean, I wanted to kind of tread a fine line in the book, because on the one hand, he did have a very glamorous girlfriend who kept a blog, posted photos of herself wearing really very little on a lot of occasions, together with Hawaiian sunsets. But in the end, we didn't run those photos. I didn't write about her. Because, I mean, she hasn't spoken about her situation. I think if she wanted to, she would have done. But Snowden himself said he basically Hawaii was paradise. He was living in paradise. Beautiful girlfriend. He was earning, including his housing allowance, $200,000 a year. This is a guy who's 29 years old. He drove up the road. He had a view of volcanoes. He was doing interesting work, and yet he threw this all away because he felt that someone had to lift the lid on what he regarded as the NSA's unconstitutional spying, which he thought was basically betraying fundamental American principles, and that's precisely what he did.
And was that something that he saw over the course of years, or was there a tipping point somewhere, some event, Luke, that made him think, all right, that's it, I have to expose this?
Well, I think it was a sort of combination of things. Firstly, he got more information. He was working as a systems administrator, which meant, unusually, he was someone who could kind of roam through the secret corridors of the NSA. He could go to lots of secret places, and he saw more material than your average analyst would have done. And secondly, I think it was to do with the political climate. Essentially, he was waiting for Obama, as he put it, to kind of reverse some of the more intrusive programs from the Bush era, such as Stellawind, for example. And when that didn't happen, I think he got hardened. And certainly by Hawaii, I think by the beginning of last year, when he got there in the spring. Really, I think this plan, even though he hadn't told anybody about it, was in his head, and he was ready to act.
Mm-hmm. And so he tries to find, this is an amazing story, Glenn Greenwald, who's not very technologically savvy, and he's off in South America somewhere, and Snowden's trying desperately to get his attention to learn how to get technically savvy so he can at least glimpse some of the incredible amount of information that Snowden has.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary incident, Kathleen, as you say. Basically, Snowden's sitting in Hawaii. He can't obviously email from NSA HQ, where he's
right.
based. He has a plan. He's going to leak information to journalists whom he likes. He likes Glenn Greenwald, follows his column in Salon, and then in The Guardian, his writings on civil liberties. And so he sends Glenn a kind of absolutely enigmatic email saying, basically, I'm a senior member of the intelligence community. You know, this won't be a waste of your time. Can you install encryption? Now, I've been to see Glenn in Brazil, in Rio, and I interviewed him for the book. And Glenn is a great guy. He's a brilliant journalist, but he's someone who is perpetually distracted. He has 16 chat windows open. He has dogs. He loves dogs. He has dogs leaping on his head. He has one cat as well. And his phone is going all the time. U.S. networks, you know, newspapers from around the world. And he has a kind of, let's put it like this, he hasn't got a very long attention span. And so this email came, Greenwald read it, he ignored it. Snowden sent another anonymous email, he ignored that too. They had a bit of a ping pong. And then in desperation, Snowden sent a kind of idiot's guide, a video, which he made explaining to Glenn Greenwald how to install encryption. And Glenn still didn't do it. And at this point, Snowden, who was trying to break the biggest leak of classified information on the planet in human history, he must have been in despair. But anyway, what he did was he then turned to Laura Poitras, the filmmaker, who does know about encryption, and started corresponding with her. And then fairly quickly, by April, May, there's a plan. And the plan is that they will meet, that Laura will interview him. She doesn't know who he is, actually. And she flies to the States. Glenn joins. A third colleague of mine from The Guardian, Ewan McCaskill, makes up the team. And these three musketeers head off to Hong Kong. They're told by encrypted chat that it's Hong Kong. And Snowden reveals his name. He says, I am Edward Snowden.
And
the rest is history, I guess.
It sure is history. And tell us a little more. He's an interesting character as well, McCaskill, who doesn't really get along very well with Poitras, does he? Eventually, they're fast friends, but initially, there's a bit of tension there.
Yeah. I mean, Ewan McCaskill, he sits next to me at The Guardian. He is a great bloke. I mean, for anyone who knows Scotty off of Star Trek, he sounds just like Scotty. He says I rather than yes. You ask him something, he says I. But he's 61 years old. He's done practically every job in journalism. He's been diplomatic editor. He was Washington bureau chief at the time of this kind of story. And the reason Janine Gibson, who's the editor-in-chief of Guardian US, sent Ewan along is because he's, first of all, he's very likable, but secondly, he's highly professional. And so when this team arrived in Hong Kong for this bizarre encounter with what we now know to be Edward Snowden, Ewan's task was to, quite calmly, do due diligence, to check him out, to make sure that Snowden mm-hmm. was real, not some kind of fantasist. So he talked to him, he asked him for his ID, passport, et cetera, et cetera. And Ewan had basically been instructed to say that if Snowden was the real deal, he should send a text saying, the Guinness is good. And if he were a hoax, say the Guinness is bad. So after 3 hours with Snowden in his Hong Kong hideaway, Snowden sent a text back to The Guardian in New York, the Guinness is good. And that basically flicked the switch on publication and on this extraordinary leak.
Yeah, what an extraordinary leak. We're going to welcome phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. Luke Harding is our guest. The book has just been released. Maybe some of you have had a chance to read it. It really is a thriller. The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Luke is an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian. He's reported from many places in the world. He's the author of Mafia State, co-author of WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy, and he's been nominated for a number of awards. This looks at the whole Edward Snowden saga, his internet postings for a 10-year period before he became involved with the CIA and the NSA, and the amount of information that he had, how he tried to reach journalists he respected to get the information out. And we have yet to get to the part of the story. Once the paper is sitting and thinking about, are we going to publish this? You know, are we sure about this? Then the repercussions that they face, not only in this country, but also in England. So join our conversation. And of course, the broader question is, it's why did Snowden do this? And a lot of people in this country have opinions that either it was a good thing he did or it was a terrible thing that he did. Where do you fall? What do you think? 800-486-8655 is the number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Luke Harding, author of The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. Our number is 800-486-8655. And Rocky from Nishkoro is our first caller for you, Luke. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you, sir?
Oh, real good.
Good.
I think what Mr. Snowden did it was a good thing as far as waking the people up and letting us know that our government is doing all the spying on us. Hopefully, we can do something to help turn it around.
What do you think we can do to turn it around, Rocky?
Well, start getting a hold of our congressmen and senators and stuff, and getting the right president in there to straighten all this stuff around.
Thank you very much for your call. Where does public opinion fall in? Is it different in your country than it is in the United States as to whether or not he was traitor or whether or not he's a hero?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kathleen. I mean, the debate here has been here in England has been completely different. I've followed what's been happening in the U.S. I've been to the U.S. a few times researching the book and afterwards, and it seems to me there's been a pretty good kind of conversation. It's been really interesting to see the dynamic that you've got young people supporting Snowden. You've got the Tea Party supporting Snowden, and then you've got a lot of people not supporting Snowden. It's almost been like insiders versus outsiders in Washington. But in Britain, it's been pretty depressing, I have to tell you, really, to begin with. Our stories in The Guardian were largely ignored. And we had British officials, the British Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, basically taking a very tough line, saying we damaged national security. I mean, of course, they never offered any evidence of this, but they asserted this a lot. And I think it hasn't really kind of captured the public imagination in the same way. And that's one of the things I wonder about. Why is it that we Brits don't take these revelations more seriously? And I think it's partly to do with our history, that we're very stable. We haven't had a revolution for centuries. And it's partly to do with a culture of deference, and partly, I think, to do with James Bond, the British super spy. You know,
really?
we think our spies are great, that they protect the Queen, that they that they're heroic and that they're noble, they get the girl. And I think these kind of cultural tropes are pretty deeply embedded in the British imagination.
Yeah. Who came to the Guardian offices and destroyed the computers, even though the information was out there elsewhere? That's an interesting story.
Yes. Well, just so your listeners know, what happened was we were publishing these stories and last summer, and David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, sent his topmost official, a guy called Sir Jeremy Hayward, who came to see us privately and basically threatened us with a legal injunction and said we had to hand the Snowden material back to the British government. And Alan Rusbridger, the Guardian editor, he said, well, you know, firstly, we're not going to do that. We're dealing with this material very responsibly. But secondly, there's no point, Sir Jeremy, because Snowden leaked his stuff to many journalists. That some of this material is with Glenn Greenwald, some is with Laura Poitras in Berlin, some is with the New York Times, with whom we were partnering. But the British government was not in listening mode. And we ended up in this absolutely kind of bizarre situation where faced with the threat of legal action, we smashed up our own computers, which we were dealing with the Snowden story, had the Snowden documents on them, in the basement of the office where I am now, watched by two middle-aged spies from Britain's spy agency, which is called GCHQ, it's the equivalent of the NSA, who photographed the whole thing on their iPhones. And it's quite hard work, Kathleen, bashing up a laptop. You need drills. It took about 3 hours. It's hot, sweaty work. There's a lot of kind of like this going on. And the spies, they brought along a little box that looks like a microwave oven called a degausser, which basically wipes data from hard drives. And at the end, we had to post these pieces of destroyed laptop into the degausser. And after about 3 minutes, there was a loud pop, and that was it. That was the end of the Snowden material in Britain. And of course, now we work out of New York. We work out of a New York division. The material is all kept in the offices of the New York Times.
Mm, what a story. Tell us about the breadth of the information, the depth of the information that Snowden had.
Well, again, that's a very interesting question. I mean, Snowden said recently, I wrote about this yesterday, he denied stories from certain officials in the White House, from the NSA and others, that he had taken 1.7 million documents. That's the figure that has been said. And he said, that's just ridiculous. He said, that's all of the information I ever interacted with in my entire career. But what we can say, I mean, I think the true total won't be known, but we are talking about tens of thousands of documents here. I mean, certainly the British material from the British spy agency, we got 55,000 documents from Snowden. But we've actually published only a small fraction of those, because what we've done is really see what's in the public interest. What Snowden said quite explicitly to Glenn and to Ewan was that he didn't want to damage legitimate intelligence operations, that he wasn't anti-secrecy as such. He was pro-accountability. And what he wanted journalists to do was use their own judgment and publish stories which revealed mass surveillance of civilians, of you, of me, of your listeners, of everybody. That was his theme. And those are the stories that we wrote. I mean, about programs which are now famous, but a year ago, who had heard of PRISM? Who had heard of Boundless Informant? And so on. And those PowerPoints we published, or we published extracts from.
Yeah. Did The Guardian, tell me about the process of deciding whether or not some of this material was going to be published. It was a scary situation because Snowden obviously was waiting for somebody to pounce on him, which could happen any minute. He felt that if it were published material, his life might be a little safer than if it were not published material. So go to the offices of The Guardian in New York, where decisions are being made as to whether or not this is going to be printed.
Yes. Well. This was probably the most. I mean, The Guardian's been going since 1824, and I think this was the most challenging story for the journalists involved in the project that we've ever dealt with. It was logistically challenging because we had a team in Hong Kong, Glenn and Ewan. It was legally challenging because obviously there's the Espionage Act in the U.S. and we were coming under pressure from the British government. And it was sort of challenging in terms of kind of the judgment call, because if you got it wrong, if we were to sort of jeopardize an operation in Afghanistan, say, or some sort of secret activity in Iran, it was clear that we would be accused of having blood on our hands and so on. And so we had to be very kind of careful. But we engaged on every single story before we published. So the first story was the Verizon story. I'm sure you remember it on June the 5th last year.
Sure.
Janine Gibson, sitting in The Guardian's Broadway office, which is not especially lavish, I can tell you, had a conference call with the deputy head of the NSA, the deputy head of the FBI, really the most powerful people on the planet, who basically told her not to publish this story, not to publish it immediately. And in the end, she gave him an opportunity to raise specific security concerns. But she wasn't persuaded that actually, you know, they had any. In fact, they just didn't really want anything from Snowden to be published whatsoever. And so we published.
Right. And did the Guardian feel that they were at great risk here? You talk about the Espionage Act. Did they feel as though somebody could really take them out? And I don't mean physically take them out, but keep them from publishing anything more?
Well, our main concern was protecting our source, because at that point, for the first few stories, the NSA didn't know, you know, didn't know who had leaked this material. They didn't know who the source
right.
was. And Edward Snowden was holed up with you and with Glenn, worried, you know, piling pillows up against the door, putting a hood over his head whenever he typed in a password into his laptop. And really the kind of Hong Kong team, every morning when they saw him, they were kind of astonished that he was still there, because it seemed improbable that he would have survived the night, but he did. So initially that was our concern. Once Snowden revealed himself in that amazing video, which I'm sure you've seen and most people have seen, then I think it became easier, because it was clear who the source was. But of course we were worried. And the other thing, of course, was that we were suddenly, the journalists involved in this, were suddenly, I think, targeted by the NSA, which was desperate to find out what we knew, what we were going to publish next, and what precisely Snowden had leaked.
Yeah. So there were some weird things going on, like people who were cleaning facilities and they had never been seen before, and taxi cab drivers in front of the building who didn't seem to be knowing where they were going. Were people looking at the Guardian?
Yeah. I mean, after this conference call I mentioned with the White House, within 2 hours, a whole series of vans pulled up outside the Guardian's Broadway office and started digging up the pavement. This was a Wednesday evening. The same thing happened outside the Guardian's offices in D.C., four blocks down from the White House, outside the editor-in-chief's Brooklyn home. And then over the ensuing days, when she was talking to Glenn Greenwald on encrypted chat, these chats would keep crashing, which is a kind of sure sign that someone is trying to hack in. And frankly, anybody, including me, who visited Glenn in Rio, immediately had a kind of really weird experience. I mean, I went there. I met Glenn in a hotel by the beach, and within a matter of minutes, various curious young men were kind of sitting around us, pretending to play with their iPhones. And so we shifted locations two or three times. These guys followed us around, and I was also accosted in my hotel room, having met Glenn, by someone who looked straight out of CIA Central Casting, with a kind of steel gray T-shirt, khaki shorts, pressed with an inch of their life, who wanted to kind of take me shopping, buy me a beer, take me out for dinner.
Oh, no.
And you know, maybe he was just a friendly tourist, but
yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And why did Snowden decide that when did he give permission to be interviewed, and why did he decide that was the way to go?
Well, it was Laura Poitras had been corresponding with Snowden for about more than 3 months before, in fact, 4 months before they finally met. She started crypto messaging this mysterious source in January of last year, 2013. And she's a filmmaker, and so she said it will really help your story and your credibility if you give an interview and you explain your motivation, your reasons for doing this. And Snowden, who had no interactions previously with journalists, he knew nothing about the media at all, agreed. He saw the logic of this, and that's how they sort of set up a meeting. And I think anyone who's sort of seen Snowden speak, of all the whistleblowers in recent years, Snowden comes across best. He's calm, he's articulate, he is reasonable. He makes a case, you know, Snowden did this, I think, for what he regarded, whether you agree with him or not, for patriotic reasons.
Right. Why Hong Kong?
Well, that's a good question that hasn't been fully answered by Snowden himself. I mean, Snowden says that he went to Hong Kong because, unlike mainland China, that Hong Kong, which is quasi-autonomous, has got a good record on media freedom. Also, bear in mind he was in Hawaii, so he didn't want to go eastwards back towards continental U.S. He wanted to go westwards away from the United States. But my understanding is he hadn't actually been there before. And, of course, you know, he got there with this plan. The plan worked far better than he could have devised. But I don't think he'd planned beyond Hong Kong, essentially. And so we then have this situation where after he reveals himself in the video, he goes into hiding, and his options are shrinking. The US wants to extradite him. And WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, the crazy Australian platinum-haired hacker who's stuck in a Latin American embassy in London, he intervenes, sends his girlfriend, Sarah Harrison, and they end up in Moscow. And there, of course, Snowden gets stuck.
Right, which is where he is now. And what about the girlfriend he left behind, and what about his family? They must have wondered. He just disappeared for a while. They must have wondered where he was and tried to find him.
Yeah, I mean, Snowden told Glenn and Ewan in Hong Kong that he was worried about his mother in particular, because his mother had been trying to reach out to him. And I'm not sure whether she got through to him. And certainly he was very upset when his girlfriend, Lindsay Mills, was basically the feds, the cops, the NSA, they swooped on the house that she had shared with Snowden in Hawaii as part of their kind of leak inquiry. And he was worried that they were harassing her. But it's quite interesting. She hasn't given any interview at all since all this happened, since June. I mean, we have a kind of forlorn final blog entry from her about how her life has been turned upside down by this. But she hasn't spoken publicly, and nor has Snowden's mother or sister. The only person who has spoken publicly has been father, whose dad, who's been to see him in Moscow, and of course has defended him.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. We're talking this hour with the author of The Snowden Files, Luke Harding, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. Luke is an award-winning reporter for The Guardian and knows all the people, of course, who were involved in breaking this story. He's reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, Moscow. He's the author of several other books, including WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy. Here's how you reach the conversation, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. It's quite a story, isn't it? Rick in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. One of the questions, I read your book. I read The Snowden Files, and I was impressed with it, enjoyed it, and I think it does give a good overview of the Snowden situation, and gave me a sense of the depth of the NSA spying, which is really deplorable. One of the questions, though, I'm remained with is, why didn't Edward Snowden approach the New York Times initially? I'm thinking of this. Daniel Ellsberg thought the Times was a paper to go to with the Pentagon Papers. But Snowden seemed to have to look down at what the Times was reporting. And it brings to mind something that's happened in the last couple of days regarding Snowden. He gave a major address, apparently, to a European conference. It was either yesterday or the day before. There was a small report on National Public Radio about it, and it was revealed in the speech that he gave that the NSA had been spying on human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International.
That's right.
So I opened my New York Times this morning, and there is zero reporting on it.
Hmm.
I'm wondering if that's the kind of thing Snowden had in mind when he didn't choose the Times. Yet I'm confused that you say there's now a relationship between the Times and the Guardian to get some of these Snowden files out.
Hmm. Okay, well, Luke can answer all this.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rick, also for your kind words about my book. I mean, I actually wrote the story for The Guardian about Snowden's address. It was to Europe's main human rights body, the Council of Europe, and you're right. I mean, he kind of revealed a bombshell. He said, essentially, that he was asked by these Europeans whether the NSA had spied on the highly sensitive communications of human rights groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. And he said, yes, absolutely, they had, including on groups like that, including within the borders of the United States. But he didn't actually name any names. Now, I don't know why the New York Times didn't do a story, but this was a live transcript. And it was quite hard to find. I think maybe they just missed it. But as far as Snowden, the Times goes, Snowden had a grudge against the paper, really dating back to 2005, when the Times, essentially a year earlier, got hold of documents which revealed that the Bush administration back then had been illegally wiretapping. And instead of publishing them, they sat on them for a year until after the election, which saw Bush back in office. And Snowden felt that this was unforgivable, so he didn't like the Times. And I mean, you make a good point. Really, we had to explain to him why we'd partnered with the Times, and I think once we'd explained that, he understood. In other words, we were being closed down, our reporting operation in London, and we had no alternative but to to go to the US. And we'd partnered with the New York Times before over WikiLeaks, and you know, it was a good choice.
Mm-hmm. How close did this whole story come from not even being a story?
What do you mean, Kathleen? Sorry.
In terms of Snowden reaching out to a limited number of journalists, would somebody else have picked it up if Greenwald just never learned how to do all this technical stuff he had to learn, or would the documentary have been made? What would have happened if everybody had just said, we don't want to do this?
Well, I mean, I think firstly, Snowden deliberately reached out to several different journalists, so he was kind of he was backing several different horses. So he also talked to Barton Gellman from the Washington Post, Glenn, Laura, and so on. And secondly, what journalist is actually going to turn down an offer of secret documents from the world's most secret agency, which Snowden said provided evidence of wrongdoing and illegality. I mean, for a journalist, this is I think for all of us who worked on the story, it's probably the most exciting moment in our careers. And anybody with any news instinct, I think, would have jumped on this.
Yeah, except that you had to go through some trouble to find out if he was for real.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is always the problem. If you're a journalist, if you do investigations, very often people will approach you or email you or call you and say, "Look, I've got a great story," and some of them, how can one put it politely? I mean, some of them don't check out.
Exactly.
Let's put it like
that. Right. And some of them are incredible. Yeah.
Some of them are incredible.
Right. Luke Harding is our guest. His book is The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We'll be with more phone calls in a moment. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Work of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tina in Franklin, our next caller. Hello, Tina.
Yes, hi, good afternoon, and thank you for your program and your guest. I used to read the New York Times until Judith Miller, but my question is, 2014, the computer, the internet, Twitter, tweet, whatnot, you can get people who get out information that tells the truth. And who do we rely on? What is, like, the truth? And, like, without getting into governments with secrecy, kind of want to know, like, where the border is between that.
Who's telling the truth?
Kathleen, yeah, sorry. Do you want to maybe reframe the question? Who's telling the truth? You mean in the debate between the public and the NSA, or
no? Who's telling the truth? Sorry. I think she was getting at what is it with all the information out there with Twitter and all of this? What sources can you use that are more truthful than others in getting news?
Well, yeah, I think the New York Times had a bad moment with Judith Miller, and obviously you're right about that. But I think what's interesting is that the big newspapers have worked on this story, so The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and also a couple of European newspapers as well, including the German magazine Der Spiegel. I think we've done a pretty good job using sort of traditional methods. In other words, we haven't rushed stuff into print or publication. We've tried to take our time understanding these documents, some of which are very technical. And before publishing, we've also talked to the relevant authorities. So I think you can have some faith in what you might call the mainstream media, but at the same time, obviously, you know, Twitter is a great, raucous, wonderful source as well. I spent far too long on it, but it's not always 100% reliable.
Thanks, Tina. Mark and Baldwin. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm just curious. We seem to keep hearing new revelations from Snowden. Who's serializing them? Is he still producing documents, or is it The Guardian and The Times that are doing that?
Yeah, Mark, that's a good question. What you have to understand is that Snowden, he's not releasing any more stuff. He's stuck in Moscow, and he did his great data dump in June of last year to Glenn, to Laura, to Ewan. And also to Barton Gellman as well from the Washington Post. And so different newspapers haven't got identical sets of the same documents. We have some. I think Glenn probably has pretty much all. Laura has some. And so we've been going through our different caches at our own pace. And when there's been a story which we've thought is in the public interest and it is ready, We've been publishing. So it's been a slow process, but there's no kind of conspiracy to keep stuff back or put stuff out. It's just a kind of editorial process trying to make sense of some documents, which quite frankly are not really written in any intelligible human language.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
I'm sorry, that was it. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Mark, for the call. When you have a massive number of documents like that, I'm wondering about the initial articles that were published, because you've got thousands and thousands of them. How did the reporters go through and decide what would be a big news story? Is that hard to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, the Verizon story, which was the first one we did, I think one of the reasons we did it was because this was something which was written in English and made sense. It was a court document. It was a renewal order from a judge saying that every quarter, you know, for a particular quarter that American telephone records would be handed over secretly to the NSA. And so it made sense. And one other thing we did was that what was quite helpful navigating through this material was that Snowden downloaded the NSA's kind of internal Wikipedia, its kind of NSA.net, which glossed, explained certain programs and so on. He did the same thing with the British spy agency. And by reading that, you then had more of an understanding of how this super complicated system worked. Those documents were also in English. So we got better. Initially, we were very slow. And gradually, we started piecing it all together.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the interconnections between the British equivalent of the NSA and the Australian equivalent. What's the deal that we have with all of these countries to help each other out?
Well, it's quite an interesting deal. It's called Five Eyes, and it was founded immediately after the Second World War, a couple of years afterwards. And it was a sort of unprecedented spying coalition, Anglo-Saxon spying coalition between Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the US and the UK, where supposedly they wouldn't spy on each other and they would share intelligence information. And of course, what happened in the post-war years is that Britain diminished as a great power. America got even more bigger and more powerful, and to the point where really the NSA was paying the bills, including for British spying. But the British actually had some pretty clever people, and so it worked kind of very well. I mean, actually, the NSA and GCHQ are practically indistinguishable. I mean, they are very, very close, and this spying relationship, I think, underpins the closeness between London and Washington politically. But just one other thing on that. Supposedly, the Brits were not spying on the Americans. The Americans were not spying on the Brits. But another document that Snowden leaked showed that actually the NSA was behaving in a very ungentlemanly way and spying on practically everybody, including the UK.
Oh, my gosh. And the reason for that, who was it who said, well, because we can?
Well, but because we can. Well, I think it was John McCain who framed it like that. But yeah, it was General Alexander, who's just actually retired as the head of the NSA, who in one document that Snowden leaked, talks about collecting all of the signals all of the time, in other words, signals intelligence. In other words, that the NSA's mission in this 21st century world was to take everybody's data, regardless of whether they committed any crime or wrongdoing or any suspicion, on a global scale. In other words, to kind of bug the entire
the world,
planet.
I know.
And it sounds incredible, apart from the fact that this is more or less what the NSA has done. It's hacked the fiber optic cables under the sea, which go around the world. It's broken into the data centers of Google and Yahoo. It's subverted encryption, which keeps all of our communications safe when we make a bank payment or so on. It's quite a nightmarish vision when you think about it. But this is the NSA's vision.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for it is so that you will not have another attack on the World Trade Center, or you won't have another incident of terrorism. That is the answer you get for why this incredibly invasive, omnipresent system that's in place all over the world. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the rationale, to avoid another 9/11. But you have to ask yourself, actually, is this the most effective way of doing it? I mean, when these supercomputers are actually hoovering up 500 million text messages a day, which is what they're doing, we know that. You can the analysts on the other end actually, even where their powerful algorithms and formulas, can they kind of make sense of all this?
And, of course,
I think the answer is no. So there are all sorts of questions about whether these programs are effective, whether they're frankly legal, and whether the oversight from Congress and so on, whether it's worked. I mean, I think it hasn't really worked in the U.S. or indeed in my country, in England.
Yeah, and all the money we're spending on it and the new buildings that we're building to house all of the information that we have gathered, we have to keep building new buildings.
Yeah, and also, of course, think about the impact it's had on America's relations with the world. I mean,
right.
Brazilians
right.
are furious. Angela Merkel, whose phone was bugged, even though she was a close U.S. ally for a decade, she's upset.
Right.
And you have to ask yourself whether knowing this mission of knowing everything is appropriate and whether it's worth it, actually,
mm-hmm.
because the bill, the geopolitical bill, has been very high.
Yeah. Why would you bug her phone, too? I mean, it's just goofy. So the story with Snowden...
Because you can. I mean, that's...
Yeah, right,
answer.
Because you can. It goes back to that. So Snowden is in Russia forever?
I think he probably is. I mean, Russia I know well. I lived there for 4 years. The problem for Snowden is that I think he would very much like to return to the United States and strike some clemency deal with the White House. But the mood in D.C. is not forgiving. That's not on the cards.
Right.
And the Europeans, even though they've been very outraged by NSA spying, haven't actually offered Snowden asylum. And I think for better or for worse, Snowden, unfortunately, is stuck in Moscow, which is tricky for him because Russia has become such a kind of gloomy,
right.
authoritarian and undemocratic place. So it makes his story a lot more complicated. But I think the best thing for Snowden would be if he could return to the U.S. And some future administration could acknowledge that what he did was overwhelmingly in the public interest.
Yeah. And if there were an outcry, you talked about the people in England not being terribly upset about all of this. I think that some of that is true in this country as well. There are a number of people who are concerned about this issue as a breach of our democracy, really. But there are a lot of other people who say, hey, whatever it takes to keep this from happening again, that there is not as much concern as you would have thought there would have been.
Well, right, but I mean, unless you kind of protect your liberties, unless you kind of stay engaged as a citizen and concerned about government, and you understand that even democratic countries can behave in undemocratic ways, I think you can lose your liberties. And,
mm-hmm.
and I do think everybody should try and engage with this because it's not just about our generation; it's about the next generation, our kids' generation. Are they going to have any privacy?
Right.
Are they?
Right.
You can be able to do stuff online. Let's see.
Yeah. Luke, thank you so much. The book is just really engaging. I'm so glad you wrote it, and thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Candy. Kathleen, it's been a great conversation.
Yeah, it's been great. Luke Harding, the book is The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man. And interestingly, Greenwald and the documentary filmmaker And Ewan are going to be in New York on Friday, I believe. They're getting a Polk Award, a major journalism award, for the work that they did. Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? Thank you to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up. We're going to do an open line. We haven't done one in a year. Isn't that amazing? And so I thought, well, let's do one. Let's get some great suggestions. So call us. Our phone lines are open, and we'd like to hear what you think about what should be on the air.